to Proto, a podcast that explores the frontiers of medicine. I'm Sarah Alger.
And I'm Dr. Lisa Iazzoni. The pandemic has been hard on all Americans. But one group has faced particular challenges. People with disabilities have more difficulties getting access to care and have been particularly vulnerable to the worst consequences of the virus.
Unfortunately, this is part of a longer story. The disability community is often overlooked in our healthcare system and given less thorough care. But recent efforts to document the problem are an important step in righting a long-standing wrong.
How do we measure disability bias in healthcare, and what can we do when we find it?
Doing better by disabled patients. Coming up on this episode of the Proto Podcast, brought to you by Massachusetts General Hospital. $61 million Americans, or more than one in four, live with a disability. While a disability may mean more encounters with the healthcare system, that familiarity is a far cry from smoothing the way to equitable care. Economic barriers keep about one in three of them from meeting their healthcare needs in any given year. But it is the less visible barriers, bias from physicians and other providers, for instance, that cause mistrust and frustration. Dr. Lisa Iazzoni has been studying the healthcare experiences of people with disabilities for more than 20 years, and is currently a healthcare policy researcher at the Health Policy Research Center of Massachusetts General Hospital. On February 1st, Dr. Iazzoni published a paper in the journal Health Affairs that examined attitudes of physicians toward this group. At a moment when healthcare is examining its own biases around race, less attention is paid to disability biases. The past year, in which people with disabilities have disproportionately felt the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, is just one reason to set that right. Dr. Iazzoni, welcome.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
Your most recent paper in Health Affairs says that evidence is mounting that people with disabilities experience healthcare disparities. What are some of those disparities?
Yes, there is growing evidence, and a lot of the evidence started with looking at the simple things. No screening and preventive services like mammography and pap tests. But we also know that people with disability are generally treated differently in other ways as well, such as having delayed diagnoses of cancer, being given different cancer treatments, actually perhaps even being more likely to die of their cancers than our other patients. We know, for example, that women with disability who become pregnant may face barriers to routine prenatal care when they are trying to come in, for example, to have their weight measures. There may not be a weight scale in the obstetrician's office. And so there's just a lot of disparities that we've seen along a variety of different types of healthcare for people with disability.
Can you tell us how this study came about?
Yes. I've been doing research on people with disability and healthcare disparities for more than 20 years, but pretty much all of that research has been talking to patients or doing analyses of huge databases. And when I would talk to patients, I'd hear from them over and over again that they were concerned that their doctors did not understand their interests, their preferences for care, what they wanted out of their healthcare, and how they viewed their lives and what that might mean for their healthcare needs.
So one of your headline findings was that 82% of the physicians you surveyed said that people with a significant disability have a worse quality of life than non-disabled people. Help us understand why that's important.
Well, if physicians think that people with disability have worse quality of life than other patients, they may be less inclined to provide the kind of diagnostic testing that might be required to understand why a patient is experiencing certain symptoms. They may be more inclined to talk about comfort measures only when somebody comes in, for example, with COVID-19, which we'll talk about later. Basically, it also sets up a kind of unequal kind of conversation between the patient and the doctor, because the patient values their life and feel that their lives are worth living. But if their physician is concerned that that patient has worse quality of life, that is a very uneven basis for having that kind of conversation about what kind of care the patient might need.
What were some other surprising findings?
Well, physicians are usually pretty confident about their abilities. And one of the most surprising findings was that only 41% of doctors feel very confident that they can provide equal quality of care to their patients with disability as they provide to other patients. That was pretty surprising. Then another surprising finding was that only about 55% of physicians would strongly welcome patients with disability into their practice. So that means slightly less than half of physicians don't strongly welcome patients with disability into their practice.
So clearly there's a huge problem within the physician community. What are some ways to begin to address this bias?
It's going to be challenging, I think, but one of the first ways is to do things like you're doing here, having me on this podcast, so we can talk about these issues and kind of confront them and say, okay, this is happening. It may not be explicit bias, it may be implicit bias, and I think a lot of this comes from the fact that many physicians may see people with disability as implicit a failure of their own abilities to cure them, that if they can't fully treat somebody and make them better, then that raises questions about where medical science is at a particular point. And so I might be overstating it, but I think that that is kind of, you know, physicians go into medicine to cure, to make people better, and if they can't, then that is kind of like, oh, I haven't really done that well by that patient. But there are a lot of physicians, you know, palliative care physicians, geriatricians, other specialties who really are beginning to kind of learn more about just improving quality of life for people in general. And so I think beginning to have training about palliation and about maybe just learning to have conversations with your patients, that one of the things that we do know from research, a tiny thread of research, is that the more that physicians actually spend time with people with disability, the more that they feel more comfortable with people with disability and the more that they value their quality of life.
So you are not only in the position of working within academia, but you also use a wheelchair full time. Is there anything in the culture of medicine that makes this kind of change difficult or easy, or maybe some of both?
I think I can't possibly say it's going to be easy, Sarah. I hate to kind of deny you that possibility that it's going to be easy. I think this is going to be tough. I really do think this is going to be tough. And yes, I use a wheelchair full time. I have since 1988 because I have multiple sclerosis now for 44 years. And so I have seen some changes over time. I think that obviously the Americans with Disabilities Act lays down some kind of rules that all patients are supposed to be treated equally. And one of the things that also has happened more recently is that equipment has become more accessible to people with disability. If physicians choose to get that kind of accessible equipment, like height adjustable exam tables that go up and down, you know, automatically, and weight scales that are wheelchair accessible. So I think setting up the facility to be accessible to people with disability is the first thing to do. And let me just parenthetically say that when you do that, it also makes it a safer workplace for you and your colleagues as a practitioner, because one of the tragic things that can lead to workplace injuries is practice assistants and nurses being injured while transferring patients onto those very high exam tables. So, but I think that also just beginning to maybe talk about this in continuing medical education venues, just becoming aware of the issues is going to be really important.
To circle back to the pandemic and the safety measures around it, how have those disproportionately affected those with disabilities, and how many of those negative outcomes were avoidable?
Well, going back to the very beginning of the pandemic, back March, exactly a year ago, I remember as soon as this started, my listserv, my disability friends, just started buzzing because people were concerned about scarcity of resources, like scarcity of ICU beds, scarcity of ventilators, let alone scarcity of very basic things like PPE, personal protective equipment, N95 masks, et cetera. And there were concerns that the hospitals were going to get overwhelmed by COVID patients and would have to institute what are called crisis standards of care. And those are guidelines that are put into place when there's scarcity of resources about who, when a lot of people show up at the door and there isn't enough to go around, who should get a scarce resource. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time that we as a nation have kind of looked at this, and lo and behold, we found that in some states around the country, that in fact, crisis standards of care were explicitly saying that people, for example, with intellectual disability should be put at the back of the line if there are scarcity resources, that people like me with quote-unquote functional limitations should be put at the back of the line. This actually was concerning enough that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights had to, last March, issue a directive saying that you could not, based on presumptions about quality of life, deny people with COVID-19 a scarce resource. But there were other things as well. As you're going to remember, people were not allowed to have visitors come into the room with them. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, a person who has an intellectual disability has lived with that all their life and cannot effectively communicate what their needs or preferences might be, was unable to have a trusted caregiver at their bedside. And so you can just imagine the terror that somebody might have experienced without a trusted caregiver there to help facilitate or accommodate communication. And then finally, just one more, you know, little short point, but a huge one, and that is that aging-related hearing loss is really common, as mm-hmm. are people who are deaf or hard of hearing, and many people read lips or want to see somebody's face to be able to communicate fully and understand what they're saying. But now, with physicians not only covered with masks, but also these face shields, so all you could kind of see was their eyes, just kind of like a little narrow band and see their eyes. People who are deaf or hard of hearing were having trouble with just basic communication. And so what we learned over time, especially at the MGH, they figured out that there are face masks that have plastic areas that allow for a see-through area to be able to read lips for people who do that to communicate more effectively with their physicians.
Has there been any good research yet about these impacts, the impact of COVID on people with disabilities?
The very first thing that you can see is the tragedy of death rates in nursing homes and congregate living facilities. So we actually don't need to even do research to know that people with disability have been disproportionately impacted, because we know that a disproportionate number of the deaths in our state and around the country have been in nursing homes and also congregate living facilities. A lot of the early research on COVID-19 and disproportionate death rates and disease has focused on the community of people with intellectual disability. And we have found that that population has just experienced shockingly high death rates from this pandemic.
As vaccines begin to roll out, are we seeing any disparities there?
We in the disability community are concerned that people with disability have not necessarily been prioritized to go, not necessarily to the very front of the line, but pretty early in the line. You know, mm-hmm. in Massachusetts, people with disability have not been put into our current priority population, which is people 65 and older and people with two designated health conditions. And some people with disability do not fall under those designated health conditions. And they are finding situations such as if they have a personal care assistant who comes into their home, a PCA who comes into their home to help them with activities of daily living like bathing and dressing and feeding and toileting, that PCA may already have been vaccinated because they were among healthcare providers and they needed to be vaccinated. The PCA is definitely needed to be prioritized, but their consumer who has a disability has not yet had their vaccination. So we are very concerned about that, that there are people in the disability community who have not yet been able to be prioritized for vaccines.
Are there any hopeful signs that you've seen from, say, the past 5 or 10 years? Is the topic being discussed more at all? Are there any promising programs out there to right some of these inequities?
Again, I'm going to have to disappoint you a little bit. It is now 30 and a half years since the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which George Herbert Walker Bush signed on July 26th of 1990. So we'll be celebrating the 31st anniversary this July. And I think that there's still a lot of room for improvement. We talked earlier about the fact that there now are standards out there for accessible medical diagnostic equipment, but unfortunately, the Trump administration did not do the required Department of Justice scoping review for designating how widely that type of equipment should be available to people with disabilities in different healthcare settings. And so although the standards exist, there are as yet no requirements that healthcare facilities actually need to have X number of accessible exam tables or weight scales. So I think that hopefully this topic will get more discussion as we move forward, but I think that there's still a lot of work to do in this area.
Thank you, Dr. Iozzoni.
And thank you, Sarah.
And listeners, thank you for tuning in to the Proto Podcast.
Today's podcast was produced by Emily Silber, Bradley Klein, and Jason Anthony.
Thanks also to our technical directors, Adam Keller and Chelsea Andes. Subscribe to the Proto Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay safe, and see you next time.